You know, I know that you wrote a book about hair first, and that's of course where your act comes from. But then you just like moved into this whole new world. Were you doing that type of work, that, you know, more spiritual inner work? Were you doing that privately at that point, and then you just decided to go public with it, or how did that all unfold?
Yeah, I've been doing inner spiritual work since I was like five. Like, it started, the question started, the anxiety, the fear of death all started and didn't leave, really. It's been spinning inside since I was very young. I started reading about, you know, like out of body experiences and meditation when I was seven. You know, I was 10 in the New Age aisle at the library, just so many questions. I was raised Catholic and the answers weren't up to my standards, you know, as far as like, they left more questions and I'm like, there must be answers somewhere. And by college, I was reading books about Buddhism. And then right out of graduate school, I went to graduate school at UNC Chapel Hill. I had a friend introduce me to The Secret. That was the big thing at the time, the law of attraction, which was kind of like, for me, a gateway drug into deeper spirituality. So it felt like my curly Nikki, the hair, natural hair success came out of, if you would have asked me 10, 12, 13 years ago, I would have said, oh, it was definitely the law of attraction. But what I can see now, it was the law of awareness. You know, I was practicing those things, you know, like affirmations, but I was really just becoming more and more aware of what was already here, you know, what was already there. I can look back on that now and see I was becoming aware of the silence. And that's, for me, been key. I just didn't know it. I thought it was the words. I thought it was the visualizations, all those things that were like creating this beautiful life for me. But there was a lot of suffering too, a lot of suffering that was tremendously needed. And it started with seemingly, you know, self-esteem, hair stuff. I didn't like my own hair. And so that's how Curly Nikki became such a powerful vehicle, because it wasn't like something I was doing to make money. It didn't start off as a business. It was, I don't like myself a lot. I don't like my hair. This is not normal for me to not like the hair that grows out of my own scalp. So I learned to love myself. I learned to love my hair. I taught myself how to do my hair, actually enjoy it instead of just like beating it into submission. And that was successful. And I wrote best-selling book, and I was on Dr. Oz for like 10 years and Steve Harvey and, you know, all these magazines and Forbes and traveling all around the world. But there was still something in me that felt empty. And now that emptiness is still here, but it is full, of grace. And I am so appreciative that I was able to discern it. And in the beginning, like I said, it felt like suffering. It felt like, if I can just get this next thing, then I'll be happy. If I can get this next accolade, if I can get this next check. But the things would come and I'm like, this is getting worse. And so I started reading books about the law of detachment instead of the law of attraction. And that took me to Eckhart. You know, it took me to Michael Singer. It took me to, they took me to Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta Maharaj. Actually, looking back at my Amazon purchase history, Polishing the Mirror by Ram Dass was one of the first books that I bought, I think even before Eckhart. And I reread it on my way to his home just like 2 years ago. And everything I share now, like, is the same as what's in that book, that initial book. Rereading it was gorgeous. If you've never read Polishing the Mirror, he actually said that Be Here Now was Maharaji, his guru's book, but Polishing the Mirror was like his work, his book. It's everything is in there. And I agree, rereading it, it's a powerful piece of work.
Amazing. Okay. There's so much you just said there. It was all beautiful to hear. And I have read Polishing the Mirror. However, I read it, I thought, you know, it would be a great like revised edition of this. You know, the cover is like reflective.
Yes.
If they just made every page inside reflective too. Perfect. You're just
turning it. We would appreciate that. Somebody new to this space would be like, what is happening? We would be like, oh, this is genius.
So how did you start like reading those books whenever you were at such a young age?
I was terrified of losing my grandmother, my best friend in the whole wide world. That was my driving force. I wanted to be I wanted to know what happened after death. I was afraid of dying myself. I'm like, am I going to go into whatever this sleep thing is that I hate and dread every day? Because I don't want to be nothing. And the whole time I'm like, I'm going to, you know, be in a coffin, or I'm going to watch myself be burned. And I'm like, and looking back, there was an awareness there that would have to be present to know that there's nothing here, or you are bored, you know? So just that motivation of what is death, that drove me to asking the questions first of my parents. They avoided and, you know, took me to the priests and the nuns, and they kind of avoided, you know, that was weird. And I had no choice. I had absolutely no choice. I wasn't getting answers anywhere. And fast forward to 2015, I'd already found, you know, and I call it love. You can call it awareness, consciousness, God, but I found it, and I'd been practicing it all year. And I didn't know at the time that it had a name, this practice. I found that out in 2016, the practice of the presence of God. And so I feel this love inside, and I get called home because my grandma is not doing well. And she and I were in the room together at the hospital when she took her final breaths. And it was like face to face with my worst, like that moment I'd been dreading my whole entire life. And it was so appropriate for it to just be the two of us. And that grief was there on the surface. And I'm thanking her, that, you know, gratitude was there. I'm loving her. Tears were there. But right behind that was that love. It didn't leave. It wasn't shaken. It wasn't any different. It was there. And I knew, I'm like, this is it. I found it. And she waited. I felt like she waited for me to find it. And then when she dissolved into it, it's like she held my hand and has held me here since then, since 2015. There's bad things have happened, good things have happened, but they're all happening in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really, really beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. Do you still think about death in a fearful way, or since that experience? Okay, you do.
Absolutely.
And yeah. Is that like a daily preoccupation for you, or something that just every once in a while kind of hits you and you have to grapple with it?
It's like every once in a while, like when COVID happened, I was doing a weekly Zoom, you know, with listeners, and this was before the podcast, and I had to stop everything because I'm like, I can't be of service until I find my ground again. And it took a little bit, you know. I was thankful for that time because I started waking up at 5:30 every day and chanting, doing my meditation practice, like really went in full force, you know, more, deeper. And I needed that. And now I think it manifests more as like, why am I always on a juice fast? You know, why am I always like, so now that preoccupation is, it's still there. It's more, it's minor, you know, but it's there because I care a lot about what I put into this body, and how and when I eat, you know. And it's definitely like, I've read so many books on like optimizing health. And mm-hmm. I think that definitely comes from that deep rooted, that initial fear.
Yeah. I mean, I have this theory that I've had for a long time that if you track it deeply enough, every single choice that we make is because we're scared of dying. Yes. Like every action we take is really because of that.
That's true.
But yeah, you know, I'm glad that you brought that up because it's something that I think about like pretty much every day, because it's such a bizarre, it's like the ultimate head trip. It's the ultimate head trip, you know. It does everything of like all of our little, you know, ego human games that we like to play, of feeling like we're in control of our situation, we're in control of our future, we are, everything is so important, you know, that it is incredibly humbling, because it's like there is no getting around this fact. And it's just this giant punctuation mark of like, you know, your time is limited. So what are you going to do with that? And I feel like that one of the reasons it's really scary to people is because that whenever they're met with that mirror of like, here is the end and what are you doing right now? They look inside and they see, you know, a lot of the things that they haven't resolved. They see a lot of the ways that they're living that they intuitively know aren't serving them well or kind of, you know, living in the way that they want. But yet they don't have the, they haven't made the connection yet of how to move onto the other side of that and start making those changes to live in a way where they thought, like, okay, if I die, like, it's cool. I know it's going to happen, but I've been in the groove in the way that I need to be until that point.
That's beautiful and very true. It's taken me years of practice, and I know it's all been happening right now, right here, but it seems like it's been a progression of acceptance, and it's not like an active thing. It's just kind of like a dissolving, and the fear comes up still, but when I see it, I know that it's not true. You know, like, this form appeared to come into existence and it will appear to die, but what I am, like, this love was never born and it's not going to die. And so that's how I think, if I can say that I have gotten over the fear at all, it's knowing this, staying aware of this. And I only fear death when I forget this, you know? Mm-hmm. So as long as I have one foot here, you know, or I always say, like, one ear on this, because for me, it's the silence that I can hear even at the noisiest concert or music festival in Austin or something, you know, I can always hear this. I can always tease it out. And as long as I can hear this, there's nothing to be afraid of. And
beautiful.
That helps. It helps a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the only truth.
You came up with a great title there. This love was never born. I think that's like maybe another book for you or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Write a book on, you know, on death or something like that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Face my fear and face death.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and of course, as you definitely know, it's like, you know, we always write about the things or talk about the things that we need to be working on in that moment. So
absolutely.
You know, who knows? Who knows? Yeah. So, what led you to, you know, actually write that first book? I know, you know, you said that you were started questioning these things about yourself, but what was it that made you go, okay, I'm going to go public with this and write a book?
Yeah. So I haven't written a book about this yet. My book was about the natural hair movement. And it's interesting because even then, that was 2013, a book felt unneeded because my website was so full, like 5,000 articles on helping women accept themselves from the inside out. And so why a book? I, at the time, still been seeing clients. I'm a psychotherapist licensed. And a lot of the people that I worked with were Black women that had natural hair that were hiding it under wigs and weaves. And they also didn't have access to the internet. You know, they didn't have computers in their home, even in 2013. You know, that's recent, but, and it sounds crazy, but it's true. And so I wanted to make something that was accessible to that audience. And when I write this book for this love, you know, that's going to be the same reason. You know, I am talking to many demographics on the surface, seemingly, but it's this love that's truly my only audience, just this oneness. But there's a part of me that knows I have to write this book for my family, you know, back in Ferguson, Missouri, for my family in Pensacola, Florida, like the people that don't necessarily have the time, that luxury to travel the world and to read, you know, hundreds and hundreds of books and to sit in meditation. And I don't know if it can be condensed and that path can be shortened, but if it can, if there is a direct way, I'm going to try to write it out and help as many of my other selves as possible. So there is a book. It just hasn't been put on paper yet.
Amazing. Amazing. So whenever you were in that stage and you went to this transition of bringing all of this public inner work and exploration that you've been doing or that you had been doing in your life and started sharing that publicly, what was it? What was the insight that hit you that made you realize that was something you needed to do?
You know, that's so funny you should say that, because I prayed to God in 2017. So this is like after the big wave of natural hair was kind of dying down and becoming the new norm for Black women. And I prayed, because this my spiritual journey had gotten so deep. And when I'm excited about something, I share. I have to share. And I don't usually have filters. And that's why I've been successful, because I share freely. And I'm like, please, God, don't make me talk about you like publicly. Please don't let me have to be this weird, you know, like, let me just talk about beauty and radiate you. Let me, you know, just fill you while I continue to do the thing that is quote unquote normal here in this dream, in this illusion. And everything was just pushing, my whole life was pushing me into this. And the next thing I know, I'm doing a daily show about this. In the beginning, mm-hmm. though, I will say the first iteration of it was more cerebral. It was more like positive psychology and, you know, more affirmations than it was what I was practicing privately. And almost like I was trying to walk the audience into this. And sometimes people message me like, oh, I really loved Be Her Now, you know, or I'm like, be the best version of yourself in this moment. And I would kind of sink in a little bit like, but you're not that person either. You know, I would kind of slip that in. But I grew more and more authentic to my private practice. And now there's no difference between what I am practicing here and what I am sharing out here. Like, it's all the same. It's all the same. And that feels good and authentic.
Yeah, that's amazing. And what you just touched on there, I think, is it's something that maybe people that aren't creating things publicly don't really have a real firm footing on. I'd love to talk about it a little bit, because it's such a fascinating process of seeing someone who's creating something, you know, you're trying to be your authentic self. You're trying to share, you know, what you find important and meaningful publicly and what will help other people. But there is this process of, like, even when you really are trying your best to do that, it's a long kind of iteration process of learning what that even means.
Yeah.
You know, like, what does it mean? And where do you put boundaries? Like, and why do you have boundaries in certain places? And how can you, you know, make sure that you're showing up in the way that you really want to. And you have to, in my experience, you have to really learn. It took me years to, like, learn how to be me in, you know, the work that I was doing, even though I was trying to do that so much at the beginning. What was that path like for you, going from doing Be Her Now to, you know, and then evolving into the Daily Show that you're doing now, and just being able to step into yourself more publicly?
It's been almost just like baby steps. Like, there were moments, even when I started The Daily Show, where I'm like, oh, I could never share about my mantra. I'll just allude to the fact that I have a mantra, but I can't say what it is. And then, you know, like, maybe 6 months in, I'm chanting the mantra on the mic, and I can't believe that's happening, but it is, and it feels right. So it's almost like it's not even you. You know, the more you are aligned with this love or the silence, the presence, whatever you want to call it, the more you feel it or hear it, the more it expresses itself as you. And it becomes a more aligned, like fully aligned version of you all the way down, like top to bottom. And I could say, oh yeah, I've been conquering my fears every day, you know, or trying to put myself out there a little bit more, make myself uncomfortable. But just like, this moment has always already been happening. You know, that moment when I finally was like, yep, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, like on the mic, like that was, I stepped into that moment, and I'll step into other ones, you know, ones that I can't imagine right now. So, yeah.
Where do you find a line of, like, as far as vulnerability goes and openness? I feel like, you know, that's an important line to understand what and why whenever you're opening and doing that. How do you think about that whenever you're sharing yourself publicly?
Yeah. So I, like, on my daily show, Good Mornings with Curly Nikki, I try not to share too much of my own personal stuff because it's not about me. But there are moments in this life where something will happen and I'm like, oh, I've got to share that. But I'm very strategic, and I say it like it's volitional, but it's like, it's very strategic how it comes out. And the story, I might tell it four times, trying to tell it four times on the mic before going back and editing it so that it is most helpful for the person that is listening, because it's not really about me. The story is a teaching moment, but it's like trying my best to take the ego out of it. And I can always hear, even when I'm, you know, just starting to record, when it's me, Nikki only, you know, or when that deeper place is being tapped into. And that's where the juice, like the good stuff, comes from. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's hard because it happens. It just happens. If you trust and you feel this love. And when I say, like, this is not flowery words, this is a felt experience. It's like a felt faith that everything is okay. I'm feeling God within me, like a body, a feeling mantra constantly. I'm not chanting Ram or chanting Christ right now. I'm feeling him, it, her, nothing. It's just this presence. And that comes out as what needs to be heard by the other party, what needs to be heard by the audience. And I trust that. I trust it. There's sometimes when I'm about to like publish it and I'm like, I share too much. Or after I get off of a call or an interview, I'm like, I share too much. I've said too much, you know. But what happened in that moment is it couldn't have happened any other way. And that's a trick that I use. I forget if I learned that from Tolle. No, maybe it was Eckhart. It was either Eckhart or Abraham Hicks. I think it was Eckhart from A Course in Miracles, him quoting A Course in Miracles. Whatever has happened, it could not have happened any other way. And that's how I move on and focus on new things, fresh things. Like it couldn't have been any other way. Next.
Yeah, I really feel that. And it's funny how every time that you have that feeling of like, did I share too much? I don't know. And you feel a little uncomfortable. Yeah. It's always the thing that people like the most. It's always what they feel, you know, because
that they resonated with. Yes.
Yeah. Because it's like at the end of the day, if you share something and you truly didn't want it out there, you would like edit it out. Right. Mm-hmm, but if you like left it in there, but it feels a little uncomfortable, it's like, okay, this is like a good kind of, I'm letting the me be out there that I know needs to be out there, but it's not the protected part of me that I normally present, you know? Yes. So what is it like doing the daily show that you do? I mean, that's beautiful.
Intense.
It sounds almost like a meditation practice in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Krishnadas talks about how his kirtan, his singing, is his private practice that he does publicly. And that's it feels like that to me. It started off as me, like I said, getting up during COVID every single morning, chanting for about 2 hours, usually pretty silently under my breath so I didn't disturb the rest of the house. And so much love would come up that all of a sudden this one who didn't even want to do a monthly podcast was like, I got to do a daily show. Like I have to share this and help people feel better, help people recognize that they're not people. And it just happened before I could even catch up with it. And like, let's say May, I decided to do it. June, first episodes were going up and I didn't have a cachet, like this huge bank of episodes. Mm-hmm. I'm just going like the day before, sometimes the day of. And I did try, you know, to record them a week out, but I felt distant. You know, I get the most feedback from the audience when I am right there with them. And they're like, you're speaking directly to me where I am right now. When I had like a week at a time, like in that gap, you know, I felt very disconnected from the work. And so that does make it more intense because I have to be here and well, you know, and present to practice and, you know, to record. But I need it because the whole time I'm on the mic, it takes about an hour. I'm here as love. Mm-hmm. I'm here as love and I'm holding that love, that body, that feeling mantra. And then I edit it down to the best 5 to 10 minutes, the parts that Nikki isn't there. Mm-hmm. And it takes every day until like 1 p.m. And I wouldn't have it any other way. I love it.
Amazing. Yeah, that's a really good form of accountability too. Mm-hmm. It keeps you, you know, tuned in and where you need to be. Yeah. That way, you know, you're always showing up, you know, how you want to be showing up.
Yeah. And it's hard some days, you know, I'm like, I don't have the words, but I just get quiet. It's no different than if I was in a situation where there was an emergency happening, you know, mm-hmm. I'd stop, close my eyes and listen for the silence. If my flight was delayed to somewhere I needed to get to really bad, stop, close my eyes, listen for the silence. You know, if my kids are clowning, stop, close my eyes, listen for silence. It's the same. When I can't find the words, I stop. I close my eyes and I listen. And then that feeling that wells up becomes words. That feeling that wells up becomes peace in the house, and the kids calm down because they're mirroring me. You know, that peace, maybe the flight now is going to take off, or I was able to be reassigned. You know, like, you just, I never know how it's going to play out, but things always work better. And even when they don't work out in a way that I would say this is good, that peace is still there. And I know that this will be good, even though it may not appear to be good right now, it will be good. And I'll see why I was delayed. Who will I meet on that next flight? Or when I get to that next airport 2 hours later, there's someone there, God appearing as this person that needs to see me, or I need to see them. And so I kind of live that way, seeing like the silver lining everywhere all the time, seeing God everywhere all the time.
Wonderful. Yeah, that openness, I feel like, is incredibly valuable, you know, to be able to not try to force the narrative you have in your mind about why things are happening in a certain way.
Yeah.
And instead accept what's arising as, one, the unchangeable nature of reality, which you can't do anything about to start with. But two, it's nothing that's happening to you. It's just happening.
Yes.
Right. And so if you can train your mind and expand your awareness to a point to where you are present with that at all times, then you're simply engaging with what is. And then what you're describing so beautifully was that then when you engage with what is from a place of curiosity, that's whenever you start being able to really tap into some of the real magic that's available out there.
Yeah. The miracles that are happening, unfolding literally all around us all the time. That's good.
So you talked about that place of stillness, you know, and that place of quiet where you can listen. That ability to be in that place is really like a superpower.
That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, for many reasons, you know, whether it be to ground yourself, whether it be to connect with gratitude, whether it's to work something creatively where you need to tune into deeper aspects of self so that you can, you know, hear what's in there, hear what's going out. And I think that through my experience of meditation, that what happens in that space is that the kind of the membrane between the conscious and subconscious mind thins a little bit.
Yeah.
And you're able to easily work with what's those deep symbolic elements that are in you trying to get out, because, you know, our brains are so weird. They spend their entire existence trying to get themselves to realize things. Mm-hmm. It's like try to get that subconscious into the conscious mind so that it can integrate again and again and again. And if you help it, then things start flowing a lot more smoothly.
So for
someone that might hear you talking about tuning into that place and, you know, the abundance that it provides, could you describe, like, what is the process that you use to get there, and then what it actually feels like so that someone might be able to understand that for themselves more clearly?
Absolutely. And if I lose my place in this story, bring me back to that question to ground me, because thinking about the title of your podcast, like, it hit me in 2017, 2 years after practicing the presence of God pretty steadily, practicing and feeling this love. It felt like I could only be aware of it in good moments, the moments that were pleasant or relaxing, pleasing to me, when I was seated on my mat, you know, or doing yoga or sitting on the rooftop when I was in DC at the time. Those moments, it was easy. If I was arguing with my spouse, you know, if the kids were crying, that it was hard, it felt impossible in those moments. And I'm like, it can't be, you know, like, I'm missing something still. And I remember in 2017, getting into my bathtub, and I can still see it, like, it's happening. And I was listening to Muji, his recording, The Invitation. If you've never heard it, listen, it's good. And I think it's on YouTube now for free. So I had bought it, I had listened to it a million times. And this was probably, I don't know, maybe like the 20th time or something. And I'm listening, and as I'm sliding into the tub, it hit me, like, right then, that no matter what Nikki appears to be doing, whether it's getting in a tub or yelling or sleeping or dancing or eating, there's an awareness. And that sounds like silence, and it feels like love. And after that moment, that's when, for real, like it started sinking in. Like, this is not conditional at all. Am I aware? That's a question you can ask yourself. Anytime something is going bad or good, am I aware? Am I alive? You know, who am I is the question that I used for years from Ramana Maharshi Nanyar, that self-inquiry. Who am I? And I used to say it like a mantra, you know, repeating it over and over again, but it's not. It's a question. And the answer is the silence that follows the question. And you just stay there and do your best to abide as that silence that follows the question. And then a thought comes about, you know, what's for dinner? And then who am I? Who's hungry? And that silence is the answer. You know, like you keep questioning, question everything. Who's driving? And then all of a sudden it's like you're seeing these hands on the wheel and you're driving better than ever, you know, because you're so present. But questioning everything all the time, it replaces your habitual negative thoughts about the moment, your narration, you know, that's usually going on. It completely interrupts the ego. And when that ego is interrupted, when that your usual inner voice is interrupted, you can hear God's voice. And for me, God's voice is silence. And you can practice with putting on your headphones. If I'm in your ear right now, you can hear me, but you can also hear silence. If you're hearing your thoughts, you can also hear silence. Hearing your favorite song, silence. Even when the notes are loud, you can still hear the silence. It's never interrupted. It's never covered up. But you have to train yourself to hear it. The way, like, I'm sure Corey can hear, you know, the trumpets, you know, in a band, even though everybody else is playing too, and all like the horn, other horns and everything is playing, you can still hear, like, that's the trumpet or that's the clarinet or that's this. You can tease it out. You have to tease out the silence and you make it your intention. And the more you hear it, the louder it gets. There's a book by Joel Goldsmith called The Thunder of Silence. And it was one of the best books I've ever read. And it brings you right here. Every word, every sentence brings you to this stillness. And the stillness is going to carry you to where you need to be, to what you need to be doing, to your purpose. If you're scrambling, trying to figure out, like, what am I here for? What do I need to do? What project are you trying to give me, God? Stop. Relax. All the teachers I have tell me the same thing. Relax. But it's not lay down in the bed or get on a lazy boy. It's the silence. Let that descend, you know, inside, be empty inside, hollow inside. And then your purpose comes from that. In the beginning, your purpose is just chill, relax, hear the silence. And then that silence takes shape. It takes shape and it doesn't take long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really great description of that process. Really, really wonderful. And I love that, you know, what that's articulating from a different point of view is like, the space between and the difference between sense information that's coming into your body and the actual awareness of the witness mind that's in your, that's really who you are.
Yeah.
And being able to pay attention for that silence, for any of the information, the sight, the sound, the touch, the smell, et cetera, that's going into your body. You begin to see that, oh, these are just mental formations moving across the stage of my mind.
Yeah.
It's just all, you know, it's all the clouds moving by. It's like, well, there it is. And now that, of course, does not preclude emotions or frustrations or, you know, negative mental narratives or any of that stuff. You're like, oh, yeah, this is just all of that moving by. Yeah. And actually, I was writing about that recently and I was describing, there's a couple of different metaphors, but, you know, fascinated me because that's something that I've paid attention to for quite a long time and I find a very useful distinction to make. But it fascinated me why people, they are aware that like their other senses, like their smell and touch and so forth, are simply sense information. Mm-hmm. But their thoughts, they aren't aware that that's just the same type of material.
Exactly.
And I thought about like, why is that, you know? And so basically what I came up with was that like, it's because our thoughts come in from inside of us that we get confused because we can see like, oh, well, surely the smell of an orange is here. I know why I'm smelling that. It's because there's an orange here. Rather, whenever you have this negative thought or whatever it might be, someone's like, oh, yes, I'm thinking I'm going to fail. it must be real because it came from within me, whenever really it's just another piece of mental information going by. And kind of the little way I used to describe that was saying, like, imagine, you know, whenever you get out of bed in the morning and you pull the covers off, you feel cold, you recognize, like, okay, that's coldness. And then you just move on, you accept and are non-attached to the idea that you were cold for a moment, you carry on about your day. And, you know, hours later, you're not still, 4 hours later, when you're in the sun, you're not going, I'm still cold from this morning, whenever I felt that for a second, right? Because you just recognized it for what it was, let it go and moved on. However, if you wake up in the morning and you're like, I'm going to fail today, you hold on to that for hours and hours and hours, whenever really it's just another, you know, just another passing mental formation. And so, yeah, being able to understand that space or the silence that you put it is so valuable, because you can really settle into who you are and just watch everything moving by. And I think that this is a valuable moment to talk about the difference between detachment and non-attachment. So I'd love to hear your take on, you know, getting into this state of mind, really resting in the witness mind, but not falling into the misunderstanding that you should be doing that to seek detachment as opposed to seeking non-attachment.
The further, and I think I said this earlier too a bit, but like the further I've gone into my practice, which my whole life is that now. So the further I've gone into this life and the true purpose of it, the more fully I'm living. In the beginning, I was afraid that, like, it did feel like two different things. When I would meditate, that was one part of my life, the part I preferred the most, and then everything else. And that division created tension, lots of tension in my relationships and, you know, my career, my business, feeling like if I wasn't on my mat, eyes closed, I wasn't practicing. And so bringing that silence with me into my relationships, I became more compassionate, you know, more loving. I could hear them more. I could see more, you know, as far as my business is concerned, as far as like what my purpose is. And so the initial fear of this is going to make me lazy or make me detached from life and I'm not going to be as effective, it has done the exact opposite of it. And you have to trust. In the beginning, it might feel like you're pulling back a little bit because you have to step back to kind of see, to get an idea of what you're not. But as soon as you see what you're not, which is everything you can see, by the way, then you're in it and you're everything and it's full and it's beautiful. It's beautiful. So you have to detach a little bit, at least in my experience, to fully dive in. And that's where I am now.
Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. And I totally agree with you there. And I don't want to say it's accidental, but maybe just I needed to cook in the oven a little bit longer. But I spent years in that state of just, I don't know if I was mistaking it, you know, this, you know, non-attachment for detachment, but maybe I was just in a Zen way, allowing myself to be a little ignorant so that I didn't have to face some forward motion and really applying myself in the way that I knew ultimately that I needed to be doing. Because I was, you know, my life was pretty easy, not a lot of resistance. I was doing my thing and just kind of living in this Taoist way of like, well, whatever arises and that's what I'll, you know, tend to. And if not, I'm just the guy chilling by the river, you know? And I thought that was the destination for a long time. And really it was about a year and a half ago that I was deep into that zone. And I started thinking about it. It just started kind of rising in the back of my mind. It's like, why do I feel like I'm like something is missing here? What's missing? Yeah. What's missing? And I was like, oh, the other half of the equation.
Exactly. Right. The other side of the coin. Why you came here.
Right. I'm like, oh, that's why the yin yang has two sides. Okay. Exactly. So, yes. So let's be engaged you know, non-attachment as opposed to disengaging.
Thank you for re-engaging. Thank you for engaging us. You are needed. Yeah. And it couldn't have been any other way. It couldn't have been any earlier than a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
You needed all of that.
Totally. Yeah, for sure. That's really whenever I started, you know, doing writing every day on Instagram and, you know, other things like that, that started in motion then was from that place where I was like, oh yeah, let's, let's actually live up to try and live up to the potential of what I can do as far as offering, you know, good things to the world as opposed to
your first discourses like the Buddha.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. Yeah. So I have to just bring it up. You mentioned the Sirgadatta Maharaj, and that's a name that not so many people are aware of.
Yeah.
And he's one of my favorite writers and teachers. An incredible, in that the book I Am That was a huge mind blower for me whenever I was younger. I'm curious, what did you take away from his teaching the most? What did it leave you with?
You know, I Am That changed my life for sure. But I can remember in 2018, I bought his last discourses, and I'm still grappling with what I read. Did you read it? His final talks?
What's it called? I don't even remember.
I don't even remember. It's an orange book. I'm sure we could Google it, but it's his final talks. And he didn't negate at all what he said in I Am That, but he took it that step further, which is like, I am not that either. Like, I'm not this or that. It's not even like you have to let go of everything, even the love, you know, like it's just the awareness that's beyond anything. From him, his words, his pointings, they hold me in truth. They keep me out beyond Nikki. And I notice that whenever anything has come up, fear around the future, you know, that worrying that's always there in the background, like running in the background, it's only because I have forgotten and I am thinking I am this, or, you know, I am that future self that's going to have it all together. It's none of that. It's none of these. But also seemingly reappear as this, you know, so like holding it all, holding all of it and simultaneously knowing none of it is here. That's where he left me. He left me without a me. and at the same time, this me is busy all day. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And it's so impossible to talk about, you know, to be aware of speaking with you and having this lovely conversation, but being fully aware that I am not speaking, you know, that none of this is here. It's crazy. It's crazy. But I love it. And I'm thankful and blessed that this is happening here, that it appears to be happening here.
Yeah,
when I first started reading this stuff, it was so hard. I was like, what are you talking about? And it felt so impossible, but it felt so true. And that's why I kept reading and I kept practicing. And I worked with so many teachers, wonderful people, you know, that didn't charge me a penny, you know, to be on Zoom calls with them, to have conversations like we're having, to compare notes. And it just started opening up like a flower in its own time. So if you're at home and you're listening to this and you feel frustrated, like, I'm not getting this, but I know intellectually, like, it's right. I know there's truth here. I promise you there's truth here. And I promise you that it'll open. You're opening. It's already happening to you, or you would not be listening to us. And just keep listening for the silence and it'll keep happening. And then you'll see. And then you'll laugh. And you'll be doing whatever it was you were doing.
Yeah. And I picked up on, you know, some of the language that you're using, and I do this too. It's funny how whenever you have that awareness in mind, that the way that you speak about the world changes a little bit in a real subtle way, and you can pick it up in other people. And one of the things you said that I say all the time is like, this appears that way. You know, you said like,
yeah, I say it all the time.
even with the most basic stuff, you know, I'll see like, it seems that that you know, jar is sitting over there. Yeah, it seems like it is there.
And people are looking at you like, it's there, dude. And you're like, yeah. It appears to be that way.
Yeah. Yeah. It appears to be July, but who knows?
Exactly. That was an episode just a few days ago. I'm like, it appears to be July. It appears to be Monday, but it's none of this. It's none of that. So let go of your expectations. You know.
Yeah. Definitely. Well, thank you so much for coming and hanging out, Nikki. This has been such a fun conversation, and you're an incredible person. And I urge people, there was some stretches of some of the things that you were sharing in the way you were talking about, you know, the experience, the internal experience, that were so rich and so full of really truth, and in the articulation is worth people listening to a few times. I think it was so beautifully stated, and so such a wonderful teaching in there. So thank you for just being yourself and showing up and sharing that with everybody.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been amazing, like to be able to speak freely with someone that's right here with me. So thank you. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.